This is a Shift Podcast Network production.
Welcome to Here and Back Again. I'm David O'Callaghan, and this is a podcast looking at all things releasing weekly on streaming and in cinemas, with a bit of pop culture bits, as usual, thrown in. Welcome, folks. Welcome to what is possibly the most insane week of content dropping all over the gaff. And it's not muck. Just like last week, there's some quality streaming and cinema releasing that will absolutely 100% keep you busy over the next few weeks. So much, so much. A box office week ahoy. Woohoo! So, shall we begin?
The first life that a serial killer takes, it tends to be someone he knows. So he gets a taste for it.
Hello, Darby. Aren't you going to invite me in?
I'm here on Andy Ronson's behalf to invite you to a retreat.
Your cell phone, please.
This is like half my brain.
Welcome. It's so exciting to see you all here.
Oh, have we got a new obsession for you. Holy moly! A Murder at the End of the World on Disney Plus is a new psychological thriller miniseries created by Britt Marling and Zal Batmanglij, who gave us the pretty awesome and quite spectacularly mind-blowing The OA. It's a murder mystery set at an isolated compound in Iceland of a reclusive billionaire. Emma Corrin, who played Princess Diana in season 4 of The Crown, plays the lead as a young amateur sleuth and hacker named Darby, who is one of 9 guests invited to the retreat by billionaire Clive Owen. But alas, when one of those guests is found dead, Darby works to prove that it was a murder rather than an accident before the killer can strike again. Oh my god, I adored this series so much. And having been lucky enough to get screeners for all 7 episodes, I binged the whole thing in one glorious sitting. It's part Knives Out, Glass Onion. It's part Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, with Darby giving off strong Lisbeth Salander vibes. Some of the other guests are fairly low-key and never fully developed as characters, but this is Corinne's show, and the mystery of it all keeps you enthralled and intrigued throughout. There's also a flashback story involving the amateur sleuthing and a serial killer, which just adds to the carnage of it all. Throw in some commentaries on AI and the climate crisis and, well, you simply have a smasher of a show which you must see, I tell you. You must watch it. Beautiful, beautiful hokum. A Murder at the End of the World is now on Disney+.
Don't really understand how I ended up here, dashing around and losing sight of myself in the process. You know, I think that's been the story of my whole life.
I'm afraid, Your Majesty, interest in the princess's private life is unlikely to die down anytime soon.
The press are on our tails constantly.
All one wants is for that girl to find peace.
The 6th and final season of The Crown lands on Netflix, with just 4 episodes currently streaming, and with the final 6 arriving on December 14th. This one takes place during the period from 1997 through to 2005, so most of the cast of season 5 will be returning. For the early part of this season, the focus understandably moves away from Imelda Staunton's Queen Elizabeth II and is better classified as the Diana part of the season, looking at her dealings with the paparazzi, the royal family, her shocking death, and the fallout from it. Definitely, this is one that's going to be quite controversial for all the royalists across the water and here. And this looks like The Crown will definitely be going out with a bang after a fairly meh season 5. So that is The Crown, season 6, part 1, 4 episodes, all up now on Netflix.
For as long as I can remember, I've had a fascination with racing. And I'm going to share a story that barely seems believable.
Jenson Button crosses the line, takes the checkered flag.
How do you feel?
It's really amazing.
Only one team in their debut race in the history of the sport have been able to get pole position and then go on to win.
This is the story of Braun GP.
In Braun, the impossible Formula One story on Disney Plus, we are invited by none other than Keanu Reeves to observe one of the most insane sagas in Formula One history, the story of Braun GP. In 2008, Honda's racing team fell into administration. However, with the help of the other teams and with Ross Brawn at the helm, the team rebranded as Braun GP. A fab Cinderella story until the other teams realised they inadvertently had created a fierce competitor and a monster. Featuring interviews by Formula One superfan Keanu Reeves, this is a fascinating sports story of the underdog, sketchy shenanigans, and as someone who is not really a Formula One fan, I have to say, I was pretty hooked. Hell, I was even charmed by Jenson Button and my mate, Rubens Barrichello, who, yes, believe it or not, I both met on a children's book junket to Silverstone for the absolutely shocking and crap Mac and Lauren books series launch. So bad. They were terrible. What a day to be alive. In fairness, I was really only there to bring our rep Norm, who was a Formula One Uber fan, and I'm not going to lie, champagne on an open-top double-decker bus driving down the M40. Oh, sweet Lord, bizarre times when books were having their Celtic Tiger moments. Money. Anyways, if you love F1 Drive to Survive, this is a no-brainer, but even if you don't like fast cars, this, as a sports doc, is a very intriguing and worthy watch. Seeing Keanu get quite giddy and kind of giggling away as he interviews these people he adores is ultra cute and worth the watch alone. So that's Braun, the impossible Formula One story, now on Disney+. By the way, in case you're wondering, those Mac and Lauren books were written, inverted commas, by Lisa Dennis, and who was married to Ron Dennis, the CEO of McLaren. Hence, Mac and Lauren, the talking, speeding cars. Sold about four of them. But anyway, who are we to turn down a visit to the grid at the British Grand Prix? Yeah, it'd be rude not to. Now that Halloween is over, yes, the inevitable floodgate of Christmas content begins. And this week, we have our first few Christmas movies.
Dear friends, family, and fellow Earth dwellers, life just seems to fly by when you're having a splendiferous time.
Oh, is that
Jennings' holiday newsletter?
It's the most absurd thing ever. I would love to show up at her house uninvited and to see the actual truth.
Charlotte Sanders?
Jackie Jennings? What are you doing here?
Are you sure you put the right address in your phone?
Of course I'm sure.
Surprise!
Grab your bags. There is plenty of room here at the end.
Best Christmas Ever on Netflix is a Christmas rom-com which stars Heather Graham, Brandy, Jason Biggs and Matt Sedano. Every year at Christmas, Jackie sends an annoyingly cocky newsletter to her friends and relatives. So Charlotte arrives at Jackie's doorstep where she tries to prove that her friend's life is not so perfect. This one looks like a lot of fun and a good start to the season, and feck it, it looks a lot less hammy than some of the usual Netflix nonsense. So that is Best Christmas Ever, now on Netflix.
Well, hello, baby girl. How are you today?
So good.
It's Christmas Eve.
Oh, yeah, that.
Your child loves Christmas. Just have fun.
Oh, Christmas tree. Oh, Christmas tree.
Dad, isn't that nice?
You sound like wounded ducks. And what was that? Do you mind telling me what you're doing in my chimney?
Can you see me?
What's your name?
My name is Nicholas Santa Claus.
Dashing Through the Snow on Disney Plus is a Christmas fantasy comedy directed by Tim Story, who gave us Barbershop and the recent The Blackening movie. It stars Ludacris, Tiana Paris and Lil Ray Harry, and tells the story of a divorced father who doesn't believe in the spirit of Christmas, but then goes on a Christmas Eve adventure with his daughter and a mysterious character named Nick. And well, I'll let you fill in the rest. Again, this looks like it's slightly caught above the usual annual AI-generated Hallmark Christmas movies. So, you know what? Count me in. So that's Dashing Through the Snow, now on Disney+. In Cocomelon Lane on Netflix, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse have returned as this preschool cartoon series sees JJ and the Cocomelon crew go on imaginative adventures as they explore their feelings and the world around them and experience life as little kids. Oh, definitely one for the smallies out there. This lot are the sketchy ying to Bluey's epic yang. But hey, some smallies seem to like it. Whoa, too creepy for me. That is Cocomelon Lane, now on Netflix. It just reminds me of Cloverfield Lane. I don't know why, but that's how much these guys freak me out.
Monarch was there in San Francisco. When the whole city was coming down, these guys were taking pictures like they'd been waiting for it.
You think that your father was working for them?
This stuff wasn't as safe.
Who are they? What's Monarch?
Kaiju Ahai! Kaiju Ahai! Yes, Legendary Studios' MonsterVerse film franchise, which features Godzilla and King Kong, releases Monarch, Legacy of the Monsters on Apple TV+. Set following the fight between Godzilla and the Titans in San Francisco in the 2014 movie, and those earth-shattering reveals to the world that monsters are real, it follows two siblings who are investigating their father's connection to a secretive organization known as Monarch. The series will split time between the 1950s and the present day, with Kurt Russell and real-life son Wyatt Russell playing the same character, Army Officer Lee Shaw, over these different time periods. Kaiju, monsters, Kurt and Wyatt Russell, shady government organizations, oh sweet lord, you know it. Shoot it into my veins. That is Monarch, Legacy of the Monsters, which is now on Apple TV+.
Who is that?
The famous Bard Russell.
In 41, you called for a large-scale march. The time has come for another.
No Bard.
I can handle all the grunt work. Rally the young. We are going to put together the largest peaceful protest made up of angelic troublemakers such as yourselves.
My friend, Dr. Martin Luther King, will be joining us.
How many bodies does it take to surround the White House?
How many? Sorry, I thought that was a setup for a joke. You literally want me to find out?
Netflix's latest Obama-produced movie is a biopic about the life of gay civil rights activist and leader Bayard Rustin, played here by Coleman Domingo. Rustin faces racism and homophobia as he helps change the course of the civil rights history by orchestrating the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. As one of the key organizers alongside Martin Luther King Jr., who made his famous I Have a Dream speech at this march. Chris Rock, Jeffrey Wright and Audra McDonald also star. It's directed by George C. Wolfe, who made Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, off a script co-written by Oscar winner Dustin Lance Black, who did Milk. Netflix will be hoping to get some early Oscar buzz on this one. That is Rustin, which is now streaming, obviously, on Netflix. Maxine's Baby, the Tyler Perry story on Prime Video, is an intimate portrait of Tyler Perry and his harrowing but fateful road to the top of an industry that didn't always include him. From his abusive childhood with a sadistic father to his love of his mother who inspired him to overcome all the odds and, yes, become the Hollywood behemoth he is today. Maxine's Baby, the Tyler Perry story, is a fascinating, worthy documentary which is now on Prime Video. And from the sublime to the quite ridiculous, Prime Video also this week gives us the new reality dating show, Twin Love, which gives the genre a new twist, as if it needed any more twists, by having different sets of twins take part. The series will explore how these twins find love and whether their romantic interest is similar to that of their sibling. Possibly creepy, most definitely weird. And I know some of you are quite excited to watch it. Everyone to their own. That's Twin Love, which is now on Prime Video.
I had a dream about that girl again.
I didn't care the first time you told me. Care even less now.
Toronto, Canada. Not too long ago.
Hey, wanna go out sometime?
You wanna go on a date with me?
Ramona Flowers has 7 evil exes, all of whom you must defeat in order to date her.
What?
Scott Pilgrim Takes Off is the new animated version of Brian Lee O'Malley's classic graphic novel, which is notable in that it features the voice cast of the actors from Edgar Wright's 2010 live-action version, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, all returning to play those characters again. So roll up Michael Cera, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Kieran Culkin, Anna Kendrick, Chris Evans, Jason Schwartzman, Alison Pill, Brie Larson and Aubrey Plaza. Oh my god, wowza. For those uninitiated, it tells the epic love story of Scott's quest to win Ramona Flowers' heart by defeating her 7 evil exes. There have been promises of some tweaks to the original story, so it'll be interesting to see if this is the good sort of tweak or the bad sort of tweak. Anyway, you had me at an anime version of Scott Pilgrim. That is Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, which is now on Netflix. All 8 episodes ready to stream from today.
Freaks you out at first, doesn't it?
Honey Snoke Skyman.
We're a top secret organization dedicated to preventing and undoing mass extinction events. Oh, and we can make time go backwards.
Welcome to the Lazarus Project, George.
What's the checkpoint?
If you use it now,
we'd wake up yesterday. Till we go a whole year and get to July 1st, 2023, and that becomes our new checkpoint.
So you can use it to go back to, like, London in the 1800s?
I'm a brown woman. Why the fuck would I want to?
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
The Lazarus Project on Sky and Now TV is a sci-fi series that follows Papa Esidu's George and his work with a shady covert agency. You know me, I do love a covert agency. But these guys can reset time and undo disasters of all kinds, stopping them from occurring. In this series, they are stuck in an infinite 3-week time loop that always ends with the world sadly being destroyed by 2 black holes converging. Absolute beautiful time jumping nonsense. Oh, sure, why wouldn't you? The Lazarus Project is now on Sky and Now TV.
I landed safe in Italy.
The Colosseum.
Oh, what? Where is it? Can we go back?
We have to go to the funeral.
What did my grandfather do?
Fia, my dying wish is that you be the new boss of the Balbano family.
Finishing off with 3 necessary clunkers, the type of thing that you could do all the ironing and cooking while watching them. First up, we have Mafia Mama on Prime Video, where Toni Collette stars as a woman who is inadvertently brought into the criminal underworld after she inherits her grandfather's mafia empire. Yes, this looks like trash of the highest order. But, do you know what? Sometimes it's good to take out the trash. Or not bring it in, take it out. And speaking of trash and Prime Video's commitment to it, 2 other movies available to stream are, first up, Muzzle. Is it trash? Because this stars Aaron Eckhart, and after his dog is killed in Skid Row, Jack Rosser plummets deep into a sinister underworld to uncover the truth about who may be responsible. It's basically John Wick light, and definitely one that the white van VHS man would be extremely proud of. So that's Muzzle, also on that Prime Video. And then Studio 666 finally turns up the 2022 horror comedy, which featured the Foo Fighters as they moved into a cursed mansion to record a new album. Yes, absolute muck, based on a story by David Grohl. Bizarre. So bizarre. How did this even get made? But now it has landed, and it actually has quite a poignant vibe as it features their late great drummer, Taylor Hawkins. So that's Studio 666, which is also on Prime Video. So yeah, finishing off there with the bargain bucket or bargain basement hits, but what a week streaming. Oh my god, you beautiful thing. And as for cinema, oh, well, bring it on.
Mr. Snow, after everything you've seen out there in the world, what are the Hunger Games for?
The Hunger Games, they're to punish the districts.
Those tributes don't have a choice.
Your role is to turn these children into spectacles, not survivors.
In Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, we return to the dystopian world of Pan Am in this prequel to The Hunger Games, which is an origin story for President Snow, who, yes, was played by Donald Sutherland in the original movies. I loved it. I absolutely adored being back in Pan Am, and straight up, I was a huge fan of the book, which this was based on, more than just a cash grab. I felt it had some depth, as does the movie. Tom Blyde plays 18-year-old Coriolanus Snow, and as we approach the 10th annual Hunger Games, Snow is given the task of mentoring District 12 tribute Lucy Gray Baird, played here by Rachel Zegler. Let's be clear, this is Snow's story, so while Zegler plays a key role and sings quite a lot, the focus here is on Snow's transition from the light to the grey to the dark side. It's also a fascinating look at the Hunger Games themselves as they struggle to maintain the interest of the public in the various districts and, you know, they're trying to beef it up and make it cool, and that's really good. And we also observe the birth of the games we came to know in the Katniss era. Viola Davis is fantastic as the slightly insane game maker, while Peter Dinklage is also great as the creator of the Hunger Games, Dean Casca Highbottom. Finally, Jason Schwartzman hams it up wonderfully as Lucretius Lucky Flickerman, weatherman, amateur magician, and obviously some sort of an ancestor to Stanley Tucci's Caesar Flickerman. At 2 hours and 45 minutes, woo! This is a long one, and I'm fairly certain a lot of non-believers, when they saw part 3 appear on the screen, thought, are you fecking kidding me? But I just say, settle in. At least they didn't split it into two movies, which would have been a disaster full of padding. If you were a Hunger Games head, you will not be disappointed, despite only a third of the movie being the actual Hunger Games. This was always going to be Snow's story, and as I said, Tom Blyde pulls off the heroic anti-hero to pure villain journey quite perfectly. Oh yes, and there's also a lot of focus on the capital. I thought that was pretty awesome. An inside look at how not all of the 1% are the 1%, and there was different classes even within the capital. Fascinating stuff. Loved it. Loved it. That is The Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which is now in cinemas.
My parents, they've got problems.
What kind of? What do you mean problems?
I don't think I'll ever go home again.
Well, why don't you come home with me? Come to Saltburn.
Mr. Quick.
Wow.
And here he is now.
Oh, what beautiful eyes. Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, I told you it wasn't a minger.
Oh, but darling, you're kind about everyone. You can't be trusted.
Saltburn is the new black comedy and psychological thriller written, directed and produced by Emerald Fennell, who gave us Promising Young Woman. Set in England in the mid-noughties, it follows a young university student, Oliver, played by Barry Keoghan, who becomes infatuated with his aristocratic schoolmate, Felix, played by Jacob Elordi, and also with his extremely wealthy but eccentric family who live at Saltburn. Set over one summer, this movie promises so much. It really steps up a gear once we get to the wealthy estate of Saltburn and we meet Felix's family, played here by Rosamund Pike, Richard E. Grant, Alison Oliver and Archie Medekwe. Kerry Mulligan also makes a brief and quite hilarious cameo as a slightly bonkers auntie or whatever her relation is. They were all pretty hilarious and really brought a manic energy to the movie. So much fun. So much fun. It also has a fantastic soundtrack, as you'd expect with its mid-noughties setting, and everything in Saltburn looks amazing and stunning on screen, but you know where this is leading, and there's a big but. Ultimately, it all falls a bit flat in its third act as it rushes to a quite predictable conclusion. Barry Keoghan is great. He does a classic edgy Barry, you know, you're never comfortable sitting around him. And Jacob Elordi will definitely appeal to his massive fan base. But for me, it just kind of went off the tracks at the end. And I just want to warn you, there are two scenes which feature Oliver. Two scenes which had the audience at my screening gasping, ooing, like, ew, and unfortunately laughing quite a bit while covering their eyes. It was, those two bits were just bizarre and did not work. So, all in all, yeah, it's a fun ride. You know, it's not going to blow your mind, but if you're looking for something hip, cool, and visually engaging, go see it. And you're not too bothered about revisiting the classic fish out of water, wrong side of the tracks tropes. Yeah, you can't go wrong with this one. You know, little past the time, as they say. That is Saltburn, which is now in cinemas. I just feel it thinks it's cooler than it actually is. You know, those type of people in college and in everyday life, you know? Anyway, moving on.
Thanksgiving is a time for appreciation. It's a time to remember our many blessings, to celebrate with the ones that we love the most. And it's time for all families to be together.
No, 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 no!
Let's see.
In Thanksgiving, Eli Roth directs this hardcore, definitely over 18s, R-rated horror in which an axe-wielding maniac terrorizes the residents of Plymouth, Massachusetts. Picking off victims one by one, the seemingly random revenge killings soon become part of a larger, sinister plan. Folks, this movie is beautifully batshit and is a welcome addition to the ever-growing holiday season horror genre. What I truly appreciated was, like in, say, a Final Destination movie, the creative deaths. Oh boy. Boy oh boy. So gory, so so violent. It's also a quite enjoyable, not really a whodunit, but who's doing it. And it played that angle very well, as you guessing to the last. Also, by the way, the opening scene, which is set at a Black Friday sale in a giant superstore, is something to behold. I mean, completely bonkers. Like, once that kicked off, I knew we were in for a pretty intriguing movie. I mean, crazy, crazy shit. After watching that, I think I'll definitely be shopping online this Black Friday. Yeah, definitely. So rejoice, all you horror heads. Thanksgiving is the furthest thing from the turkey that a lot of people maybe expected. And as I said, if you are a horror fan and it's your jam or cranberry, well, it's definitely one that comes with a big thumbs up if I had any left. That is Thanksgiving, which is now in cinemas. Music wise, nah, nothing much to talk about this week, and I have a few books to talk about, but we'll push them to next week, because you know what? Three things, make it 72 things, because now that the strike is over, holy crap, there's so much news breaking, I'm just going to have to put it into, like, categories. So, yeah, let's go with that. Three things we noticed in pop culture this week. First up, Netflix Give It and Netflix Take It Away. They announced this week that they were culling a lot of their shows, and not going to lie, a lot of folks, yeah, got upset. Lee Bordurgo's Shadow and Bone was the biggest one to fall, cancelled after two seasons. Its first season was an absolute smash for Netflix, but with it being extremely costly to make and with its second season viewing figures falling off a cliff, it is gone. In the bin. Kim Cattrall's Glamorous, which I actually quite liked, was dropped after one season. But rejoice, and they think it's all over. No, no, it's not that it's called. Oh, and just like that. Those fans, because does this mean she might be free now to bury the hatchet and turn up for season 3 of the Sex and the City spin-off? Let's see what happens. In more positive news from Netflix, Day Cadine is in the gaff. Yes, Netflix will be moving filming of season 2 of Wednesday, their hit show, from Romania to Ireland in the new year. Better tax breaks, greener pastures, and let the Jenna Ortega spotted in the batter goss begin. Warner Brothers, or Warner Discovery, whatever you want to call them these days, are also in the news this week as they did another Batgirl and Scooby-Doo tax break special and canned the new John Cena movie, Coyote vs. Acme. What's weird here is that, unlike the other ones, this $70 million production was actually complete and had scored quite well in test screenings. But money talks, as does tax breaks, and Warner weren't willing to risk adding another $70 million to the marketing budget. But that is not the end of the story. After a lot of talent involved found out this news through social media, that is where it all kicked off. The director, composer, and numerous other Hollywood talents all started asking, why work with Warner when after 2 years they can kill a movie for tax breaks with it never seeing the light of day? Warner kind of freaked out, slightly backtracked, and then offered to set up screenings and show the movie to streamers, etc., to see if anyone wanted to buy it. So it may not be in the dumpster just yet. With all the hype, I'm fairly confident that someone like maybe Prime Video is going to step in and throw all the cash at them, because there's a lot of hype going on. And I'm sure you're saying, what is this movie about? Well, in classic Roger Rabbit style, it's a live action mixed with animation flick where, after all the products made by Acme Corporation backfire on Wile E. Coyote, in his pursuit of the Roadrunner, he hires an equally unlucky human attorney to sue the company, played by Will Forte. When his lawyer finds out that his former law firm's intimidating boss is Acme's CEO, played by John Cena, he teams up with Wile E. to win the court case against him. Why the hell wouldn't you watch this? Lord and Miller of Spider-Man, Spider-Verse and Lego Movie fame, who saw the completed movie, tweeted this week, saw Coyote vs. Acme and it's delightful. It's funny, charming, good physical comedy timing with a surprising amount of heart. I hope several studios go after it so the world can see all the good work people did. Interesting times, folks. Interesting times. Finally, Marvel, sweet Jeebus, they could have had five things themselves this week, so I'll try capture it all under one umbrella known as Shit's Going On at Marvel. Captain America Brave New World has been pushed back to 2025 after the Hollywood trades reported some very negative feedback at test screenings, and the likes of Kevin Feige and other Marvel leaders were like, uh-oh, they were not impressed either. This is like the Daredevil all over again. That leaves only Deadpool 3 coming in 2024 from Disney Marvel, which is on the big screen, which is kind of bizarro. But maybe that's not such a bad thing as they attempt to redirect the ship after their recent dip in form and last week's The Marvels pretty abysmal box office. Shocking stuff. But that's not the end of it. That is not the end of Marvel, because it was also revealed this week that this course correct has also seen screenwriter for Avengers Kang Dynasty, Jeff Loveness, who did Ant-Man Quantumania, was dropped from the project, as was the Shang-Chi director Destin Daniel Cretton from the same movie. Whew. Rumours therefore are currently swirling that after a less than stellar reaction to Jonathan Majors Kang, in general added to his legal issues, Disney are possibly going to move on from the Kang storyline completely and head elsewhere. Maybe Doctor Doom? Yeah, who knows? Is there any positive news for Marvel, I hear you ask? Well, again, the trades are reporting that Pedro Pascal has been offered the role of Reed Richards for the Fantastic Four, and his acceptance is imminent. Unless it's a curveball and he's actually Doctor Doom. Yeah, we'll see. Vanessa Kirby, who appears in Napoleon next week and is most excellent, is also the hot favourite to be the new Sue Storm. So there you go. You see what happens? The strike ends, and just like some buses driven by Richie, a shedload of gossip turns up all at once. Right, I reckon we should depart now. You have a lot of homework to do anyway this week, folks. Go off and enjoy the madness out there. And with that, this is David O'Callaghan for the Here and Back Again podcast, wishing you all the best, and until next week, stay safe and binge happy. Oh, my voice is on the edge. I'm losing it, folks. Oh my god. Right. Yes. But you know what? I know you've been waiting. I know you're out there, my post-credit travelers. Well, hello there. Welcome yet again. Yes, a place where anything goes, truths will be told, and definitely, definitely this week, meandering, rambling tales are a given. Well, this week's tale of yore comes from a land before time, known as the 1980s. Inspired sadly by the passing of Hollywood artist Roger Castell, whose most famous creations were the Jaws and Empire Strikes Back posters, as I sit here, I am podcasting under the glow of my Empire Strikes Back framed artwork, which to this day, we believe, Roger Castell gave to my dad, who was head of RTE's printing department at the time, and who bonded with him and kind of, when he was over for a Star Wars exhibition, and kind of, he said, here, have this for your kids. Could dad confirm his actual name? No, because God bless him. God bless him. There was a lot of people in that day from Lucasfilm. Anyways, this beautiful framed piece of art with no movie text, just the Empire Strikes Back imagery, came home and was given to my older brother Paul, as I said, in 1980. What's interesting is this is not the original poster that was released here. This was the French poster, and only in recent years has it become the hot favourite for Empire Strikes Back. But where the story takes a twist, and apologies to anyone who I've told this to a million times, I repeat, this one in a lifetime piece of history of art was given to my older brother Paul, and yet from 1984 to the present day, it has been my pride and joy on every wall, front and centre of every house I've ever lived in over the past 40 years, even surviving the carnage of Maynooth College. I don't know how it wasn't stolen down there. Anyway, I know what you're thinking. Wow, what a brother. What a feckin' hero giving such a beautiful thing to his younger sibling. Well, that's where things get quite interesting, and of course it has to do with football. In 1984, Arsenal sucked. I mean, they came 7th in the league and were knocked out of both the FA Cup and the League Cup by lower division opposition. Paul, like myself and Dad, were huge Arsenal fans, but alas, he had reached his limit. To Terry Neill, the manager, and said they were an average football club, and in a moment of weakness, he flipped to, wait for it, Everton. Why? Because they had just won the FA Cup over Watford, and that was that. I was distraught. What an absolute glory-hunting traitor! We had supported the Gooners all our lives, and suddenly he's a feckin' Toffee supporter. I tell you, I was apoplectic, as they say. I was outraged. And then, folks, this is when my war of attrition kicked in and my long game, my long-term goal of Operation Empire took shape. After trolling him for many months ahead of the new season and shaming him whenever I could about his loyalties, he cracked. He saw the error of his ways, like any normal football fan would do, and he knew he couldn't desert the Arsenal, and his brief dalliance with Everton was something awful that needed to be corrected. He apologised and swore he was back on board. Yet my 1980s version of waterboarding him continued with me saying, whatevs, sure you'll just flip next time we lose and head off glory hunting again. It was then that those immortal words were spoken. What can I do to prove I am a true Arsenal fan? Oh yes, it all clicked into place. Beautiful, beautiful times. Years in the long grass had finally seen me get a lawnmower, and I was about to mow it all down. So here's the deal that we brokered. I offered him a pair of Arsenal socks, and in exchange, to prove his loyalty, he was to give me, yes, the Empire Strikes Back framed artwork. Oh yes. Did he blink? Possibly. Did he sweat for a day or two? Definitely. And then he basically agreed that if this is what needed to be done, so be it. Well, nearly 40 years later, it's possibly still one of my proudest moments. Hey, I even think Dad appreciated my gusto and the fact, through my intervention, he had bought his sons back with the Arsenal. As for Paul, whenever he visited any of my houses over the years, even to this day, as he steps into the sitting room and this joyous, wondrous piece shines down from the wall, he never fails to utter the words, "You're some dickhead. I still can't believe I did that." But you know what, Paul? What I say to you is, you could be supporting Everton, and that there was my gift to you. So, Roger Castell, RIP, you legend of a man, and Paul, well, I'm possibly about to find out if you do listen to my podcasts. And with that, let's sign off with this week's musical earworm. 60 seconds of tunage that was floating around in my head this week, and I'm not going to lie, it's a bit of a banger from 1991. Right, over to you, Jesus Jones. Take it away.